Welcome to the Interracial Drawn Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined by...
Very white guy.
And you're very white indeed.
I'm feeling medium white today.
Me, just the medium white?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know.
We should get to like Rachel Dolezal's scale of whiteness and see like where I am on the whiteness scale. I'm always whiter than her, though.
I don't know about that. I'm always stealing from black people is the whitest thing someone can possibly do.
I guess I should say, I'm always whiter than she thinks she is.
I guess that's true. But that's everybody, I think. You know, she's down. Anyways, if this is your first time joining us, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can also find us on our website, interracialjohn.com. And, of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Just search at Interracial John, again, J-A-W-N. We also love feedback. We haven't had any feedback in forever, man. You guys
I haven't really searched, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe we have one. I'll look right now.
Maybe leave us a review. And if you leave us a five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher, shout out to the black guy who tips, Rod and Karen. We will read it on the air. You can also send us email at interracialjohn@gmail.com. Again, interracialjohn, J-A-W-N, @gmail.com. And brand new, you can also leave us a voicemail. Just dial 657-JOHNERS, 657-JAWNERS. If it's under 3 minutes and not batshit crazy, we will play it on the air.
Batshit crazy.
Yeah, because I can't play batshit crazy.
There's yet another non-US. Yeah.
So if you're not in the US and you sent us a five-star review, you need to just send an email to interracialjohn@gmail.com or just hit us up on Twitter at interracialjohn and just let us know what country you're from so we can find it, because iTunes does not make that very easy.
Yeah, there's like
to do.
Four or five random.
We're going to have to go through that one day.
Found the one in, was it Finland?
It was Finland. Shout out, Finland. All right. Well, what's going on?
Fucking, we moved.
We did.
And we're living in like a dorm apartment, I feel like.
Oh, God, it's the worst.
I don't mean to knock people living in apartments or dorm apartments, but I feel like I feel like I'm in college.
Yeah.
My audio video equipment's on wine boxes and shit.
Yeah. It was just a hard transition from our like nicely well-appointed full house to this.
That was a dope as shit house.
Yeah, the house was great, but I just mean more that like it was, you know, our stuff was everywhere where it was supposed to be. And
yeah.
I'm very discombobulated here, so we need to find a place soon.
And then what's up with fucking Comcast, man? We're in Comcast
world
now.
Well, as we knew before we moved here, Comcast sucks. So it's sucking here already. We've already had the guy out. Mashed up cords in the walls and some bullshit-ass story about a tower somewhere. You know, they're so full of shit.
The thing that pissed me off about that, and if anyone's listening, you know we had Rod on from the Black Guy Who Tips last week. Shout out, Rod and Karen. How you doing? Thank you for coming on the show. And you don't know due to dutiful production quality on the back end, Carl, you know what I'm talking about. So Leslie did a bunch of editing, but fucking shit dropped out like every...
Oh, my God.
The internet
and
dropped
like,
out
for real,
like
we have guests on all the time. We've never had a problem with any tech on any guests at all. Of course, we get the most important guests we've had so far. No offense to any of our other guests, but we've been building up to having Rod on. He's my favorite podcaster, and just as big a deal when Karen came on. This was an equally big deal to me. So yeah. It just really sucked not having it work.
He was
correctly.
Super chill about it.
He was great.
I know what happens.
He was great, but it just really sucked because it broke the flow. That was what upset me more.
Really, yeah.
The editing, I don't mind that much of it, but it broke the flow of the conversation. We were talking about pretty heavy stuff with all the Rachel Dolezal stuff and all of that crap, but it was a great show. And thanks again to Rod for coming on. It was really awesome to have him on.
I've seen no less than like three white potato salads at the D&W Super Fresh this year.
You have to take a picture and tag
I
him.
I should have.
You need to. It's hilarious.
Potato salad.
So yeah, we are getting used to things here in Michigan too. It's a little slow out here.
Whoa. A little?
Well,
And
we went to the grocery store. Finally, we've been putting it off, getting takeout every night. And I was like, listen, we just got to go to the grocery store, get some fruit, get some veggies, get some, you know, frozen meals in the fridge, get some, you know, food.
Here's the thing, though. They had a gal unload our cart, another person check us out, another person bag it.
Oh my God.
And all three of them were at like glacial speed. But you can't really bitch about it. Like, you're helping me. You're like,
they wouldn't let us do anything.
Yeah,
she's like, well, I'm just staying here so I can do this. And then I was like, am I supposed to stop unloading if you're unloading? Like, I don't know the etiquette for that, because that's some weird shit. We don't do that out east. You unload your own cart, and you're lucky if there's a bagger. If usually the person ringing you up is your bagger or you bag it. So it was extra like weird. And then the guy doing the bagging used like 15 different kinds of bags. We bought two big bags in with us to like, you know, reusable shopping bags. Yeah, yeah. And neither of them were filled to capacity, yet he started using plastic bags.
You know what? I have a perfect example of the pace of life with which is here in Michigan, and that's split checks. Because no fucking other place on earth have I been on where having a restaurant, there's four people, two couples, even two people. Doesn't matter. Every goddamn waitress comes up. Is that on separate checks?
Everybody's getting their own check. And I was like,
two and two? You know, two, huh? You two together, you two together?
Honestly.
And it's such a standard practice that they don't even like, it's weird. It's like almost like, what's that like, you know, Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill all the time? Like they've been doing shit like really like weirdly for so long that it's like just is. It's not really like a nuisance. Whereas like, you know, in Philly, New York, you ask a waiter to split a check. They're like, the fuck? I can't run six credit cards. That's a hassle.
No,
that's a pain
to
in the
me,
ass.
I think it's something different than that. I don't think it's anything to do with the establishment because plenty of establishments will split checks.
No, I'm not talking about the establishment. I'm talking about the area here. They don't mind. One, the split check is because it's like, you know, Dutch and kind of like, you know,
it's cheap.
Cheap. But
that's the point.
The waiters and waitresses have accepted the fact that cheapness is
coming. Well, they have no choice
coming.
Because they're cheap. So it's like not really an option. I'm saying, like, literally.
They're not even upset. About it. They're just like,
how can
split
you be
checks?
Upset? The person you're paying is cheap too.
You just assume and split checks every single time?
Yes, because people don't want to pay for anybody else's stuff. And like, honestly, out east, I'm insulted if somebody splits
yeah, me
a
too.
Check. I'm like, you're getting a separate check? Bitch, please. Like, it's insulting
it,
to me.
It really is. It's if you say to me while we're out that, you know, should we split checks? I'm like, are we not close?
Like, what's going on
if
here?
We're close enough to go out to dinner, I think we can do the math.
Yeah. Or just split 50, it. Yeah. That's a normal thing to do, but whatever. So that's kind of strange.
And I've never been with another couple where, like, you know, like one of them's like, I'll take the surf and turf, the lobster thermidor, the, you know, 20-year-old
Yeah, I'm not
friends
with those people.
Me either. No. So it's not an issue.
No, it's not an issue at all.
But split checks is weird.
Yeah, that's strange.
Like a breakfast place.
There's yeah.
You're like, going to put $7?
Breakfast place. Yesterday I saw four dudes in a car going through the McDonald's drive-thru.
Yeah.
And they each got a separate check, separate order. And I heard the guy who was like, for order number three, I'm going to get blah, 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 blah. I was like, you're in a car. You have to split it there too?
Yeah, apparently.
It's McDonald's. All right,
get that shit right.
I see you.
Did I tell you I got added to a couple of Twitter lists today?
Oh yeah, what lists were those?
Very randomly. I think people like just use like hashtags differently maybe, or I use them wrong.
They probably like set them up like automatically.
It probably is. But so I told Reign of April was Dragon. I can't remember the dude's name, but the soccer player that's kind of like disowned his daughter. And
oh yeah, that douchebag.
He blocked her on Twitter. Yeah, his name's not worth mentioning.
Way to go, dude.
But Reign of April and like Jimmy LeMieux and a few other people were just, you know, it's Father's Day, dragging him through the internet gleefully. And I think Rain said something like, April said, you know, retweet this if you've been blocked by this guy. And like his daughter, you don't know who he is. You know, like something really just like, come on. So I was like, oh, this is hilarious. You know, tea has been sipped. Where's my popcorn? And right away, someone's like, tea drinkers, added to the list. Like,
Now you're a tea drinker?
Yeah, I guess, because nice. I put tea will be sipped.
Who else is on that list?
There's like thousands of people.
Of course. All so it's like anybody who mentions, oh, tea.
It's all British.
Oh, so it's like real tea thing.
It wasn't people.
That's hilarious.
It wasn't like the sipping tea.
It wasn't
tea.
Like the black colloquial.
No, that wasn't.
I'm going to just brew my
vernacular.
Tea.
No.
It wasn't like, the Kermit the Frog tea.
No, it was like actual Earl Grey, like 4 o'clock.
Highly
crimpets
hilarious.
And tea time.
That's
tea.
Funny.
And then Judy Jackson from the Good and Terrible shout out, Good and Terrible podcast shout out. One day.
Hey,
she they have their Cold Slither premium network and they've got a new sports show and she was announcing it and I was all like, hey, you know, cool, congratulations. She said something like, oh, you're gonna come on and dish up some sports? And I think I said, well, only, you know, I'm a sport elitist and I only follow one sport and that's lacrosse. And I was being like sarcastically because, you know, very white guy. And she's like, aha, funny. Again, like 30 minutes later, added to a list, like lacrosse enthusiast.
Lacrosse
yeah,
enthusiast.
Like people that like support and talk about and worship lacrosse. It was pretty goddamn funny.
That is really funny. All right. Why don't we get into the show?
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
So, Brian Williams is not coming back to prime time as a news anchor any longer. They've officially announced that he's not going to be returning to the anchor desk. Lester Holt is formally taking that. He's going to stay on at NBC, but he's going to be doing like specials. I'm skeptical of even that because they said that same shit about Ann Curry, and I think she's been like locked up in a hole since then. But anyways, if you recall, he was suspended for 5 months for lying about being in a helicopter that took hostile fire over Afghanistan, and so he's been gone and off the air. So he had his first interview since then, and on the day of this announcement with Matt Lauer. Let's play some of the interview and just see what he's got to say for himself.
In his own words, what has 5 months been like for you?
It has been torture. Looking back,
it's just not right there. Didn't the report on torture just come out like literally like last week?
Yeah.
And he's going to say it was torture.
Is it torture?
Brian.
You sitting in your penthouse?
No. Who's the victim? Brian. It was like torture.
Oh, boy.
Stop.
Oh, boy.
I have discovered a lot of things. I have been listening to and watching the what amount to the black box recordings from my career. I've gone back through everything, basically 20 years of public utterances.
Why? Did you have doubts about some of the things you've said over the years?
I was reading these newspaper stories, not liking the person I was reading about, wanting, I would have given anything to get to the end of the story and have it be someone else, but it was about me. These statements I made, I own this, I own up to this, and I had to go through and see and try to figure out how it happened.
Your family,
stop right there for
personally,
a second.
What and why these 5 months been
I'm
like?
Sorry. You
need to figure out how it happened. Well, you just
correct me if I'm wrong, though. Correct me if I'm wrong. What we're talking about, the it,
yeah,
he's,
the
how, it happened,
how it happened,
was him
uh-huh.
going on various news programs over a period of a few weeks or months and talking about an incident in which helicopters took fire. And over a period of statements, his involvement and proximity to this fire escalated and changed. First, the reality is the helicopter wasn't anywhere near him. And then it was a helicopter in his grouping. Then it was a helicopter that he was in took this fire, right? Yeah. Like, so he's
it progressed. It got worse. How, like, more involved.
It happened as you opened your mouth and fucking lied.
Well, let's see.
Why do you have to figure out how that happened?
How did it happen?
I'm sorry.
You talked?
I don't understand that.
Okay, let's see.
It has been a time of realization, trying to find out in me what changed. You know, in our work.
This is some white ass shit.
I was thinking the same thing.
Holy crap.
First he said, I'm the victim. It's been torture.
It's been
then
torture.
He's going to spin it around. I had a lot of work to do in me.
Let's get through this. I can't even.
Focus on me here.
Focus on me here, guys, because I'm supposed to be a reporter. Oh, hold on. I'm looking to play.
I have always treated words very carefully. That's the coin of our realm. That's our tool. It's the key to our credibility and our integrity. But, Matt, it is clear that after work, when I got out of the building, when I got out of that realm, I used a double standard. Something changed, and I was sloppier, and I said things that weren't true. Looking back, that's plain.
Is he talking about because he was he was on like Letterman, so he was out of the realm of news. You were on fucking TV. That's out of the realm of news?
I think they call that lying.
But he's still, the equivocation's unbelievable. Well, it wasn't a news station.
Yes,
and a
he's
news program. He's
qualifying.
It was Letterman. Okay. It was the day. It was
sloppy.
You know.
So did you not
sloppy
deal
that's
with the reality that when you walked away from NBC, whether it was to appear on a late night talk show or some other venue, some other interview show, that the title and the responsibilities of anchor / managing editor of Nightly News traveled with you?
I think that's exactly it. Looking back, it had to have been ego that made me think I had to be sharper, funnier, quicker than anybody else. Put myself closer to the action, having been at the action in the beginning.
But was it conscious, Brian? Because let's go back to January when you went on Nightly News and you recounted a story about a military veteran who played a role in a harrowing chopper ride you took while covering the Iraq.
I'm not even going to get to the rest of this bullshit. What? It was ego, Drew. Ego Williams.
You know, we and if you
So this is some new shit.
I was saying, if you're a loyal listener to the John, we've talked about some various imitation apologies, things that masquerade as apologies.
Right.
And I think we've witnessed a birth of a new one.
So first, let's go through the ones we already have. We have the unpology.
Yep.
And that's where they said, I'm sorry you're offended, or I'm sorry you're upset.
And you know what I love with these is the analogy with, I punched you in the face. Right. I punched you in the face. Right. I'm sorry your face hurts.
I'm sorry your face hurts.
I'm sorry you have a black eye.
Sorry that you feel like you're going to throw up.
Yeah.
There's the no apology, which is, oh, I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah.
Something terrible. Oh, my family's hurt too.
I punch you in the face. Oh my God, I'm so sorry your face hurts. Or I'm so sorry that happened. Right. You know, that's a bummer.
There's the non-apology where it's like, I don't know what, the devil made me do it.
What was that? The teacher?
The devil was in the house.
Is that an apology? That's a non-apology.
That's the non-apology, because there actually is no apology involved.
None at all.
And now this was from Brian Williams. We got the, I think we should be calling this the why-pology.
Yeah, where he just talks about all this stuff, explains it away. But never once says, I'm sorry.
Never says I'm sorry. Never says the word lie or liar.
Nah.
Oh, wow. Brian.
Why has it happened? Why did this happen? I had to dig deep and look at the black box. His phrase there, the black box. That's almost like he was like chiding all of us for being able to go back. Like, because you've got me recorded, you went through and looked at all the scrutinized and look at my stuff. It's a black box. It's not fair.
Oh, my God.
He's a victim.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
So, unpology, no apology, non-apology,
why apology. So, congratulations, Brian.
I'm going to proffer another one. I think we saw two this week.
Oh, yeah? What's the other one?
The apology? And I'm going to give that to Chuck motherfucking Todd.
Oh, fuck Chuck Todd.
I mean, really. And do we need to play the Meet the Press clip?
Let's just play his intro. I don't want to actually hear the video, but I would like people to hear.
That was President Obama Friday in the wake of the Charleston massacre on the issue of the availability of guns in America. Earlier, we heard the moving words of family members of the victims. So this morning, we wanted to take a look at American gun violence from a different perspective, from that of the person pointing the gun. We have a remarkable video to show you. NBC News producer Dan Slepian volunteered to make a video about gun violence on his own time with convicted murderers at Sing Sing. It's the infamous prison just north of New York City. The circumstances you are about to see are very different from the racist violence in Charleston. In this case, the inmates are African American that you're going to hear from. But their lessons remain important. And we simply ask you to look at this via colorblind issue. It's about just simply gun violence.
I'm just out of the horse fucking shit.
The fuck entire. And then they proceeded to play a 5 or 7 minute interview with 5 black men who had killed someone with a gun and them talking to their former 12-year-old self. First of all, for you to be a fucking news program and
gross.
Your response to 9 people being killed, black people being killed in a church by a white gunman, is to put this propaganda ass bullshit
white supremacy
on the air.
PR, man.
It's disgusting. We can't dehumanize these pretty close to perfect victims.
People that were in Bible study
so
in the church.
Let's just make white people think, well, black people use guns too, so it's okay, guys.
Well, there's a lot in this video that I think deserves unpacking in that regard. But I personally have been increasingly irritated with the focus on guns and gun violence in this specific instance in Charleston and from all fucking sides, right? So from people that are on the liberal side, they're taking this because, you know, I don't mean they, I shouldn't say it, but frequently gun the discussion around guns seems to happen in immediate proximity to a tragedy that involves a gun. That's like the only time consciously Americans and think pieces and people start talking about fucking guns and legislation, literally, right? So you kind of like, okay, expect that, but it distracted so deliberately from the fact that this was a racist hate crime. Like, you know, and like we've seen it in so many ways. Haley said, well, we don't know why he did. We don't know why people do this. Despite a manifesto that said,
why?
I'm going to go kill black people and start a race war. Despite me telling my roommate, I'm going to kill black people and start a race war. Despite me telling the black people I killed that I'm killing you because I want to start a race war. Like, you know, like, I don't know why he did it. Right. So that's all going on. And the pivot to just talking about guns, it's frustrating. And I'm like I said, I'm seeing it on all sides, man. And,
it's crazy.
He's doing it now. And then in the manner in which Chuck Todd and Meet the Press decide to do it is to put up like you're right. It was basically like, oh, you know what? Hey, you're right. A gun was used here and guns are bad, but psst, 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 psst,
Black people use guns.
Black people kill a lot of people.
They kill a lot of people. Look at these.
Look at these black people.
Look at these bad black people. Nine of them were killed. These five guys did this. It's an even trade, guys. You can go to work Monday morning and not have to deal with feeling bad at all.
You know,
it's disgusting.
It's the
and a few things that were weird about it too. Why mention that his producer did this on volunteered
on
his own time? Does that mean he was just sitting there waiting to be sprung into action when it was going to be the most horrendously offensive to black people?
That's going
to
come up in his double down apology, but yeah,
it's fucking ridiculous.
And then again, the imploring, look at this with a colorblind,
which is just
lens.
Just even saying, you know, those
you
words,
know, you know,
just even saying those
he,
words.
If you uttered that out, you fucking know that this shit is about to fucking, and maybe it's a troll, maybe it's exposure,
maybe it
troll.
Is exposure trolling, because wasn't nobody talking about Chuck Todd yesterday?
No way.
Well, and beyond that, my other thing too is like, it's such a fucking sham, like, oh, we want to make it about, because I guess talk about his apology now and then I'll talk about this other point. What did he fucking try and say? He didn't apologize. He just said he was. He felt fine. He said it's
our
job.
I'll read it. So this is why it's the apology. It might even be like the WTF apology.
Yes,
but
what the fuck?
We've gotten a lot of feedback about the gun video we showed on Meet the Press today. Some were upset it only featured African-American men talking about their regrets of pulling a trigger. All of the men in the piece volunteered to be part of the video and the larger project is a part of. Okay, so there's more equivocation. But the last thing we wanted was to cloud the discussion of the topic of guns. Not the discussion of the topic of white supremacy and racism in the Charleston church. Not that, but guns. The original decision to air this segment was made before Wednesday's massacre. However.
Bullshit.
However, the staff and I had an internal debate about whether to show it at all this week. When we discussed putting it off, the conversation centered on race and perception, not the conversation we wanted the segment to invoke.
Mm-hmm. Yet it did, and you played it anyways.
We decided against delaying the segment because we wanted to show multiple sides of what gun violence does in this country. Mm-hmm. Or slander black people.
Or slander black people and subtly tell white people it's okay that these nine black people were killed.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. We thought that the issue of gun violence in our culture and society was an important conversation to continue. Right fucking now you did? Right fucking now.
Let's stop right there. This is my point I want to make. If you think that the gun violence conversation is a conversation to be had, any honest conversation about gun violence needs to start with talking about gun manufacturing. And if you're starting with the bullet that comes out of the gun, then you should, you're not here in an honest regard whatsoever at all.
Well, how about any conversation that includes cops?
It's fucking
bullshit. We have to arm all cops.
That's what I'm saying.
Uzis?
That's my point is about the manufacturers. That's where we should be talking about. So don't come to me talking about, oh, we just want to talk about gun violence. You don't actually want to talk about gun violence. Right, if you did, that's not what you would be talking about.
I'm like one paragraph away from the granddaddy, the what the fuck part of this podcast. It's been pretty what the fuck, but he's about to go full what the fuck. We thought the issue of gun violence in our culture and society was an important conversation to continue, too important to put off for another week. The consequences of gun violence should not be hidden. Really? Consequences of gun violence? Okay, anyway. As I say to all audiences, Meet the Press should make all viewers uncomfortable at some point, or we are not doing our job. I hope folks view the gun video as a part of the conversation we should all be having and not the totality of it. Honestly, just listen to that. Like, we're making you uncomfortable with our racism. That's our job.
Our job. It's our job to be racist.
That was the point.
I want to ask, do no white dudes in Sing Sing prison in New York?
Certainly not that this fucking
on his own time he
time
went to go do it.
And
to me, that was important. Cover. That was cover for them.
This is important.
No. That was cover for
them.
Oh,
sure. They got
because
fucking,
now,
they got
now,
to fucking,
now they have somebody to fucking
scapegoat.
Oh,
totally.
You didn't even put a white guy. Well, we didn't produce it, so you can't hold it. We would have put other people in there. It's fucking bullshit. They started off in the intro covering themselves. That's how I know they know this is bullshit.
You know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. We've got nine black individuals that died in a horrific fashion, and it's supremacy and a racist. And
white people aren't feeling bad. And they feel bad, Drew.
No, they're the perfect victim, is what white America,
that's
right?
Why. They feel bad.
So we can't do anything. So what are we going to do? Let's slander black people in general, because black people are a monolith and they're all guilty by association. And, you know, we can't slander these nine victims. So we'll just slander a bunch of other black people and hope it all comes out in the wash, because it's just absurd. It literally is white supremacy propaganda. It was so unbelievable. And I I guess that's a apology or a what the fuck apology, but it wasn't no apology. It was a double down.
It was terrible.
Well, it was a double down and then saying, well, you should be uncomfortable when we're racist.
When we're racist, we mean to be. That's what he said, was saying. Thanks for letting us know. And Tim Russert is rolling over in his grave right now. And fuck you. Fuck you, Chuck Todd.
Yeah. Damn. The fuck.
Yeah. So speaking of live TV, one of my sisters interrupted Don Lemon, and I don't even know who this other guy is on TV, live on TV. So let's just give her a moment to say her piece, because she really wanted to be heard.
And tell me now, have you talked to your friends? Have you had a chance to communicate with others who were at this high school with this man who is now basically accused out in public of a heinous crime?
It is a terrorist attack. White people
are I had to hear you on the TV.
Emmanuel Church. The church itself is not open for some time. I'm joined now by Don Lemon, who's here with me.
And a friend.
Yeah, I missed a little bit of the show. Yeah.
Well, you can understand why people are upset because, you know, this is...
Hold on a second. They sent Don in because of this black lady. You realize that now, right?
Oh, wait, he wasn't on this.
No, he
piece
wasn't
before?
In there. You could tell he was that guy was supposed to be doing himself, and he's like, I'm joined by Don Lemon, like, all uncomfortable. for real.
Is,
that's what just
so this
happened.
This woman's been cussing Don Lemon.
You can hear the producer like, ma'am, and they're like, send Don in, he's black. Fucking CNN. You're such a piece
they
of
shit. They had Don on call.
Literally, he was standing over there.
He's in the wings. He's on deck.
She walks up to them. Because Don, now that Don's in it, she in it for real.
This doesn't happen. This shouldn't happen to anyone. The whole thing that we have been talking about is whether this is terrorism or not. And I think it is terrorism. By any stretch of the imagination, you can understand that people are upset. But, you know, we're going to continue to talk about that.
The president himself said he's angry today.
Right.
And local leaders said they are angry, too, that violence is
happening
in the church. But everyone I've spoken to as well has also talked about healing.
Yeah. I just think it's really sad that when we have nine people who've lost their lives.
We're
going
to take a break.
And
we can
have to deal with something like this. But I think it's important, too, that people see the ignorance with it.
Get off your knees and stop
she
praying.
She said, get off your knees and stop praying.
She got real.
She's a very free black woman. God bless her. I don't know who she is, but I was
Shout
happy
out.
To see
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that was friggin' awesome.
Serious badassery.
On the lighter side, yes. I saw this thing, professional cuddling is now something in Maryland.
No tendonite. If you need a hug, there is a brand new company that can help you. It's called Tender Embrace. For as little as $40, you can cuddle with a stranger. Lauren DeMarco joins us live now with the details. All right, Lauren, everybody at home is saying, what? Are you serious?
Yeah, you know, and if your remote control and maybe, you know, a little fuzzy pillow have become your only companions, you may be craving a little bit of human contact, and this company is really banking on that. But they insist that it's not about romance. It is about platonic touching. Take a look.
It releases oxytocin, serotonin, dopamine, all the
is
different
that the dude that's
that
gonna hug you?
Naturally creates.
He's way too hairy.
He looks like me, though.
Esteem,
it doesn't
your
look like you.
Of acceptance.
Rob Andrews and his wife Tiffany believe in the power of human touch.
They're swingers.
Along with their business partner, they're taking job applications, hiring cuddlers for the cuddling store they're planning to open this fall.
A store?
The idea came to them because of difficult times spent apart when Rob was deployed while serving in the U.S. Marine Corps.
Just wanted some touch, and it would have been amazing just to have somebody just to cuddle and watch a movie with and not have to worry about somebody trying to fill me up the entire day.
The Tender Embrace website is already active. Services include timed cuddle sessions starting at $40, appointments with two cuddlers at once,
overnight cuddles
involving movies
what?
And snacks, and for $500, an overnight session, although that will only be available to select established clients.
Wow.
This sounds so shady.
Wow.
This is a high-class escort service. They think they slick.
There is to be no discrimination based on race or gender, and all sessions will be monitored by video feed for security.
Oh, that
and
sounds good.
And although it's strictly platonic, they're covering their bases, the site even acknowledging the possibility of a natural occurrence.
At that time, the provider would ask the client to switch positions so that's not the focus of the cuddling.
The plan is to open up shop in Maryland or a nearby location to generate business from DC and Baltimore. So yeah. Demand depends who you ask.
Sounds like a good thing for people like widowers, maybe.
Widowers!
people going through depression and just need a hug.
Sounds like a weird and terrible idea.
Shout out to weird and terrible. I'll stop it now. Just that guy. A weird and terrible idea.
That is so funny.
Overnight cuddle, though? Come on.
Oh, my gosh.
Overnight cuddle? That's a little...
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know about that. I'm a little...
Yeah.
I'm a little like...
Yeah, please.
I don't know. I question that.
Oh, Lord. So also in the news, Detroit City Council rejects a plan to extend youth curfew over 4 days. After a public hearing comment on the inflammatory issue of a plan to extend the curfew for youth in Detroit from 1 to 4 days, council members voted against the ordinance that would have required anyone age 17 and under to be accompanied by a parent or guardian beginning this Friday during Detroit's River Days Festival and popular annual fireworks show.
Wait a minute. They were making a curfew just for the weekend?
Yeah, it would have extended from... In effect from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. Friday through Sunday, the 19th through the 21st, and for the Freedom Festival's fireworks over the Detroit River, Monday the 22nd, from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m.
And who put the plan forward? Why was this?
The police. Of course. Who else?
And they rejected it, though?
Yeah, they did reject it. And it was just like, you're criminalizing these people. It's just kind of crazy. The police chief, of course, said the proposed curfew was not meant to stereotype or criminalize, but to keep them safe, which sounds like a complete crock of shit. Ron Scott of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality said this new ordinance creates a Soweto-like police-controlled and monitored zone, which restricts the movement of our young people in the designated area. This draconian measure flies in the face of the city of Detroit's anti-profiling ordinance. It's ironic that it is being proposed at a time when America and Canada are celebrating their democratic traditions.
For real. And I mean, just like think of how deep you're really talking about restricting individuals, predominantly black, in a community of moving around certain hours. That's like straight up like slave times. Like you need a pass to leave the fucking farm and go from one place to another for a day.
Absolutely.
And like, oh my God.
Yeah, he's a resident. Eli Kandrum said these ordinances are perpetuating fear and distress among the young people of Detroit and the police force. He says there's no worse feeling than being treated like a criminal for doing nothing. No worse than being discriminated against because of a factor you can't control, be that race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or age. Detroiter Marco Wallace, 17, says penalizing all teens for the expected bad behavior of a few is a little harsh. He says, I'm 17 turning 18 this year. Why can't I go downtown to a fireworks festival? I might as well just buy some fireworks and have a little festival in my front yard. And of course, you know, a lot of other people were coming out saying that it was bad. Last year, over 100 minors were detained by Detroit police for violating a curfew on the night of the fireworks event, which draws thousands
How much money do they make?
Which draws thousands of white revelers to the city each year. Because that's really
it's protecting what the issue is. Protecting a white space. It's insulating a white
space.
It's making a white bubble in a predominantly black city for white people to come in and spend fucking money.
So gross.
And they're making money arresting people. And that almost, again, it smacks of like when slavery ended, like it you know, I like to say chattel, I don't, most people say traditional slavery ended. Yep. And, you know, they went like all the farms and shit, like that free labor didn't miraculously get converted overnight. They had to, you know, find a way. And the way they found was arresting people. And they'd bring you in on prisons. They'd make you work labor on the farms. And they'd arrest black people for, like, vagrancy and all kinds of just, you know, made-up horse shit. And this sounds just like that. We're going to make a law, a curfew, and then we're going to disproportionately apply it over a period of time and profit off of black youth in this instance. It's grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, that almost should have been in this segment. Bad boys, what you want, what you want, what you gonna do? When shall the John Brown come for you? Is there ever going to be a week when we don't have a Yes All Cops? Has there been one where we don't have Yes All Cops?
Nope. Well, you know, the police in many cities have been blaming black protesters for various mysterious crime waves in a bunch of cities.
I draw this back to Ramos and Liu, the two police officers that were killed in New York. From that point, it's been, you know, that's the narrative.
Yeah. So the NBC News asks, as violence spikes in some cities, is Ferguson effect to blame?
That's the thing. They're calling it Ferguson effect.
Apparently, that's in quotes there.
Lovely.
How many New Yorkers must die before the mayor brings back stop and frisk? Blares the New York Post.
What?
Which claims that you're 45% more likely to be murdered in Bill de Blasio's Manhattan, basing their claim on an increase in murders from 11 to 16. This is hysterically bad math. Even if the increase is something other than statistical noise, someone needs to explain to them that a 45% increase does not make every single person 45% more likely to face violence.
And it went from 11 to 16.
Fuck. Yeah.
In the island of Manhattan.
Yeah.
11 to 16. And a place that's got millions of individuals.
Yeah.
It went from 11 to 16.
Uh-huh.
And the headline from that is, you're 45% more likely.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's Heather McDonald, who she's the classic example of apologists cherry picking the data, as you always say. There's what statistics reveal and then what they don't. Even in crime, if crime is increasing in some cities, what about others? So they don't really actually give you the details. First of all, something to note is that crime was at historically low levels for both 2013 and 2014 in a lot of places. So any increases in 2015 would probably actually just bring it to the mean. It's not going to continue in the historic lows forever.
You need to look at a long year trend.
Yes, it has to be longer than that. But we'll go on. Overall crime is actually down 6.6% in New York City. Small numbers are routinely twisted into scary statistics. One murder in 2014 and three in 2015 could mean violence levels are historically low, but still be presented as misleading 300% increase.
Sure, right. Went from 3 to 1. It's a 300% increase.
I said that in the New York Times. And he says he's reminded of the old Mark Twain line. There are three kinds of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics.
For real, man.
But then what about claims of the alleged crime wave is the fault of protesters in Ferguson, and Baltimore, Cleveland, or elsewhere?
Is this the article saying you're calling crime wave? Or is that just pundits and shit?
Pundits and NBC News and a bunch of other sources
what
as well.
What crime wave?
Or that it is the inevitable result of curtailing mass racial profiling and unconstitutional stopping and searching of African-American, Latino, or poor Americans. These claims are even more flimsy because these people don't even try. She says the most plausible explanation is agitation against police departments, but provides exactly zero evidence to this fact, none at all. But let's look at the actual facts. The Ferguson protests erupted in the summer of 2014, but by McDonald's own admission, crime continued to decrease through the end of the year. So shouldn't we have had an immediate increase if African Americans were to blame for the lawlessness or stop and frisk in New York? From 2011 to 2013, the number of police stops dropped by 75%, but the number of shootings and murders also decreased by 29%. Murder in New York City was at a historic low in 2013. In 2014, de Blasio's first year in office, police stops declined, and yet murder rate also fell to another historic low. Interesting. For better or for worse, stop and frisk has not disappeared. It's simply been curtailed. For more than a decade, NYPD stopped nearly 4 million people, most of them black or brown, and the gun recovery rate was a pathetic 0.016%.
Their own data said that they were more likely to find contraband or weapons on white people, yet they stop and frisk black people at like a rate of 8 times more. It's
right.
Absurd.
Mm-hmm. It's just so ridiculous. So, yeah, cops suck. Y'all just making up shit, trying to blame protesters for everything, and it's gross.
I miss some things on the internet. And, I tweet a bunch. I don't always see everything. And I had not seen this, crime wave narrative.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Crime
They've
wave.
Been talking, oh, yeah. Like they
crime
said,
wave.
Oh, you know. That's what led to the whole, go away, DeRay. Because there's this idea that these outside agitators are coming, and they're the ones that are creating racial strife. Not white guys going into churches and killing 9 people, not that,
yeah.
Or police taking innocent black men into vehicles and them dying as a result of a severed spine, not that. It's DeRay and his vest, by
sure,
the way.
Sure, and or the 9 people that were killed that is the reason he's there.
Yeah.
And nothing says we're not racist at all and don't need you, DeRay.
By
like telling a black man
to
get the fuck out of town.
Out of
right. That's you guys.
Nothing racist about that.
They're totally under control.
we are all about black people doing whatever they want, except for you, DeRay.
Tip of the hat to you, Charleston. You're doing it right.
White people.
For real, but there's another, we got a new segment.
You are like so very white. Seriously, the whitest.
I think that's another segment we're never going to run out of.
Yeah, so very white, we will never run out of the so very white segment.
So a professional baseball team canceled Caucasian Heritage Nights.
Ooh.
And guess the state.
Oklahoma?
Utah. You're in the right area, though. And I guess I thought Utah was whiter.
It was a bad marketing move by their team.
There's no shortage of people taking a swing at the Orem Owls.
Why does there have to be a special night for just Caucasians? Why can't anybody have the, you know, join or come in?
The promotion known as Caucasian Heritage Night has drawn intense fire on social media and has brought the national spotlight to Orem's minor league franchise.
In light of everything that's happened in Charleston, South Carolina, it is very troubling.
Earlier this week, 9 people died in Charleston in a shooting believed to be racially motivated. Janetta Williams with the NAACP described this kind of event as dangerous.
Especially now where there's so many white supremacist groups out there and they're looking for something like this.
The Owls organization has officially canceled the event, posting...
Not you gonna read this. Our night was to include Wonder Bread on burgers with mayonnaise, clips from shows like Friends and Seinfeld, and trying to solve the vertical leaping challenge. We understand, in light of recent tragic events, that our intentions have been misconstrued. For that, we sincerely apologize. So not for doing it, but because they were misconstrued.
But you know what? Misconstrued. I'm going to give them a little bit of a pass because I could see like a really like crappy event planner at the. Because, I mean, it's like the River Sharks, right? They have an event planner there.
There's a history of minor league baseball teams doing wacky and goofy
and
crazy
stuff. Yes, they do
crazy
stuff like digging up diamonds in the infield and all this stuff.
Yes.
And I'm sure somebody was like, oh, I went to this, you know, white trash party the other day. We had Cheese Whiz and blah, blah, blah. And stuff. That kind of conversation could lead to this stupid-ass bullshit. But what's shocking is that nobody in the organization. It just tells me they have zero black people working there. Because, honestly, that's the only explanation.
I actually thought Utah was going to be pretty white, but it's not even top 10 whitest states.
No, Maine's the whitest state.
But where Orem is, this county, Orem County.
Oh, that's super white.
Is super white, right. Like 98%.
So it's like, why don't you just give everybody the hot, just make the, like you didn't have to say white Caucasian appreciation.
No, but again, that's probably.
Just say it was like throwback night, that's it.
I'm not making excuses, but that is part in history of the like, you know, doing goofy and wacky things. Like it's a version of exposure trolling. Like we're going to have, you know, bring your toilet bowl to this. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
You
can do like burn your disco records.
Yeah. They do weird stuff.
Right.
But this, the fact that it, and let's be clear, it didn't just like get run up the flagpole as an idea. Like they did it. They released it. They had like flyers and fucking promos built and they like sent it out to everybody like, hey, 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 it's Caucasian Heritage Night. And instantly Twitter was like, whoa, the fuck. And then they came back and apologized and canceled it. But, like, it went through the entire vetting process, like, all the way.
Absolutely. So that's kind of crazy. So I was in this self-care group the other day and somebody had wrote, like, this is on Facebook. What do you do when you're feeling down and, you know, kind of get yourself out of the doldrums when, you know, shit gets, you know, fucked up and all of that. So people were saying, I do this, I do that. And somehow somebody mentioned like, oh, I listen to, you know, ratchet trap music. And then, you know, that helps me feel better. And they were like, what's trap music? Like they had never heard of trap music. I was like, wow.
You're introducing people to Big Freedia, I bet.
So I was like, well, that's bounce, which that's a whole separate section. Oh, but yes, I did. It segued from trap music to New Orleans bounce, and people were posting videos, so it's pretty funny. But I found this article, Trap Queen and Other Black Songs White People Love Way More Than We Do.
Oh, I bet you there's a bunch on here that are on my list.
Yeah, so... essentially, everything about Fetty Wap is an abnormal, is an anomaly. His name sounds like a colloquialism for masturbation or a great value brand version of a money dance. He's from New Jersey, yet sounds like an Atlanta artist. And while he reps Haiti to the fullest, he isn't remotely West Indian. For real, he had some griot and decided, yep, this is me now. We live in an era where Chris Brown and Lil Wayne can become Make-A-Wish Foundation honorary bloods, and Rick Ross is still purporting himself as a Colombian drug lord. So why can't Fetty Wap be a Haitian ATL if he wants to?
I actually thought he was Caribbean. I really did.
Yeah, well, Fetty did too.
You're saying he's not? He's like from the States?
He's from New Jersey.
Of course it's Jersey.
Of course he is. Everybody's from New Jersey. So they didn't know they hadn't heard the song. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, if you want to hear, this is the trap song.
Coming in hot. Coming in hot.
RGF Production.
Yes, Carl, I'm Cabbage Patching.
17:30, I'm like, hey, what's up, hello? Sent your pretty ass soon as you came in the door. I just wanna chill, got a sack for us to roll. Married to the money, introduced her to my stove. Showed her how to whip it, now she remixing for low. She my trap queen, let her hit the bando. We be counting up, watch how far them bands go. We just set a goal, talking matching Lambos. A 56 a gram, 500 grams, though. Man, I swear I love her, how she worked the damn pole.
Hey.
In the strip club, we be letting bands go. Everybody hating, we just call them fans, though. In love with the money, I ain't never letting go. And I get high with my baby, baby. I just love the mall, I'm getting fly with my baby, yeah. And I get robbed with my baby, baby.
I'll be in the kitchen making pie with my baby. I love this song.
I think everybody loves that song.
I love this song because it's like, it's hella ratchet, but it's so sweet. He's getting high with his baby. They're making pie. I mean, come on. This is good stuff. It's like a very like cute trap love song. So I appreciate you, Fetty Wap, and your one eye. So they go through a bunch of other ones. One is Bling Bling. The OG of this shit, really. A white person wouldn't know BG if he came from if he came from the hole in the wall, saved them from a house fire, and took a selfie outside their burning home, and pickpocketed them because BG looks like somebody that would pickpocket, that would save you and then pickpocket you. So let's get Bling Bling up here.
Save you and pickpocket you?
Yeah, he'd do both.
My watch, it's Wayne, baby. Thugs out, won't change, baby.
Hey.
I do your main lady in a blue navigator. That's game, baby. You can call me a game shooter. But since I drive a bubble, people call me Lex Luger. I pull up in the expedition. They be like, no, 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 he didn't. Tattoos and fast cars, do you know who we are? I'm Lil Weezy, putting it down for Slim Ball.
Bling, bling. Every time I come around, bling, bling.
Think it rang, but about it.
Bling, bling.
Every time I buy a new ride, bling, bling.
Yeah, white people like that song.
I'm here for Lil Wayne. Oh, yeah. Goddamn JD.
Black, white people definitely like that song. Next on the list is...
Dude, Millie, dude, that album was hot.
Yeah. Next on the list is Ignition Part 2.
Oh, my God.
Was there actually an Ignition Part 1? Never mind. Don't answer. It doesn't matter because whichever song came before it was irrelevant because when R. Kelly gave us the preview of the remix, nothing was the same. Then White People Columbus did. Despite that fact that they don't even have froze to rub hands in.
I love the shit out of this song, I can't lie.
Now, usually I don't do this, but go ahead on, break them off with a little previews of the remix. Now,
I'm not trying to be rude, but hey, pretty girl, I'm feeling you. The way you do the things you do reminds me of my Lexus cool. That's why I'm all up in your grill, trying to get you to a hotel. You must be a football coach, the way you got me playing the field. So, baby, give me that toot-toot, and let me get that heat-beat. Running her hand through my throat, bouncing on plenty foes. Why they say, hang it up, ready. It's the remix to Ignition, hot and fresh out the kitchen. Mama rolling that body, got every man in here wishing, sipping on coke and rum.
I could just play that shit all fucking day. Y'all know that's my shit.
That is your shit. But you don't have a Frodo Rub
I know,
hands
but
through, so that's song really
was
y'all
just,
Columbus in that one.
I don't care. I just you can't. You can do a lot. Yeah, I will
defend.
I will
the
give up
sanctity of.
I will give up my white privilege and my whiteness,
uh-huh.
And I will fight for black liberation. But
right.
God damn it, you can't take Ignition away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse.
Next up is Single Ladies. Who doesn't love a good breakup song by a happily married woman? It's petty, simple, and despite all the dancing in the video, when it comes on the club, it really just requires your single ass to wave your drink in a circle, which white women apparently love to do.
And can do.
Mm. Next up, we have All of Me. Radio had already made a consensus decision to do away with any R&B love songs not sung by a white person. Then in comes John Legend with an ode to his wife, and white people ate it up because they love them some Chrissy Thiegen. So much that John is basically able to dangle her in front of them like a carrot and be as unapologetically black as he wants without any backlash. Chrissy Thiegen gives John Legend whatever the opposite of a hood pass is.
The white card?
Yes. Next up, Riding Dirty.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's my shit too.
Me rolling.
Hey.
They hatin', patrolling, and trying to kiss me riding dirty. Trying to kiss me riding dirty. Trying to kiss me riding dirty.
Tryna kiss me riding dirty. Tryna kiss me riding dirty. My music's so loud.
That was a hype beat too. You just couldn't deny that shit.
But is there anything more ironic than a song about racial profiling blowing up and white people still not believing it exists? No, Billy, not one. No one is trying to catch you riding dirty with your suspended license. Also, for the record, that Sound of Revenge album banged. It did. Debate your uncle's new girlfriend who insists you call her auntie and likes all your Facebook posts. Coming up next is Hey Ya. Hey Ya is the perfect storm. iTunes had just launched and people were able to buy songs from artists they weren't really checking for. So while white people ain't really get Speaker Box the Love Below, they did rock with the song that kind of sounded like the Ramones and told them to shake it like a Polaroid picture.
I feel like that song in particular was like, it was maybe the beginning of either ringtones or like songs were getting like just a lot of play in commercials. Like I felt that song was everywhere from a marketing perspective for white people in particular.
Right.
Like I heard it at the fucking dentist chair. Like yeah. you couldn't get away from it. It was everywhere.
Nothing quite tells the bar we're about to play some hip hop like
this is how we do.
When this happens, white people lose their collective shit. I seen it.
I'm losing my shit right now.
I would make the argument that white people ain't checked for nothing else Montel did. But hey, neither did black people. This is how we do it. It has over 25 million YouTube plays, and Montel doesn't see a dime of it. Pay your taxes, America. Oh, and hire an accountant.
When did this come out?
I don't know. I would guess like 94,
95.
Is
that late?
Yeah.
I felt like there was a bar.
This is how we do it. It's Friday night.
Yeah, you would have been in college.
Yeah, I feel like there was a bar that had like a CD and they would put the CD in at like 8 o'clock and hit play. And this was like right around like 11 o'clock midnight.
Yeah, that was a signal. We got to get it.
It was paired with like Down with OPP, yeah, like a bunch of other shit white people would go like, yeah, that's my song.
Next up, No Diggity. Blackstreet's most popular song on Spotify has 50 million plays. Their second most has 3 million.
Whoa. They're 50 million.
They're both somehow No Diggity.
Possible.
What's also fascinating about this song is that the slang that makes the title and chorus never caught on. Black and white people formed a united front to not let Diggity happen.
Yeah, and now, did Will Smith do a song with Diggity or something? Teddy, the original rough shaker. He did Jiggity.
Get Jiggy with it, yeah. Nobody went with that either. I do like this song, though.
Another sick beat.
Teddy Riley. Getting paid as a forte each and every day. Can't stay away.
I can't get it out of my mind.
Wow.
I think about the girl all the time. Wow. East side to the west side. Pushing fat rides. It's no surprise. She got tricks in the stash. Stacking up the cash. Fast when it comes to the gas. By no means average. It's on when she's got to have it.
Yeah, I like that song.
Me too.
Next up. Since I'm not Gwyneth Paltrow, I can say Niggas in Paradise. It's been 4 years since Watch the Throne came and went, and I still don't see the appeal of this song, but white people ate this shit up so much that niggas performed it 11 times in a concert in Paris. 11. They only said Niggas in Paris one time in the whole song. It's still befuddling.
They played this 11 times? Mm. In one concert?
I guess so.
Let's go!
It's a hot beat, too.
I like all the parodies to this song. Yeah, they had like the librarian one. Read so hard, motherfuckers trying to find. Librarian's trying to find me. They had one like at Princeton. It was pretty funny. Then we have a miscellaneous dance song, whether it's the Soulja Boy, them Franchise Boys, Cali Swag District, or even We Are Troons. My God, these names. White people love a good rap song that comes with dance instructions, and black people love cheering white people on when they attempt to do these dances.
Man.
Mm-hmm. And last, Happy. You know what, white people? Y'all can have that one.
You know what? And that was another one. Like, it was inescapable.
Yeah.
Again, same, like, at the dentist, in the elevator, you know, at the grocery store, old people, young people.
Everybody.
And then there's all the, like, people were doing, like, lip dub videos.
Yeah,
it
was just too much. So I brought up, when we were in the same trap music discussion, brought up New Orleans Bounce. You mentioned Big Frida. So, well, let's give her a little shine. I love Big Frida.
Stop all this foolishness, cause Uptown trying to shake.
Y'all get back now. Y'all get back now. Y'all get back now. Back now.
Make it clap, make it clap, make it clap, make it clap.
Tune it up, hot, hot, girl, let's go. Shake for the money. Bounce to the floor. Tune it up, hot, hot, girl, let's go. Y'all get back now. Y'all get back now. Y'all get back now. Y'all get back now. Y'all get back.
Yeah, I love Big Frida.
And what is Big Frida's preferred pronoun?
She.
And what's her? They have a TV show too, a reality
show? She does have a TV show. I think it's just called Big Frida. It's
awesome.
It's on the Fuse Network. She's so awesome. The thing I love, I mean, obviously
she's real as hell.
She's so super real, and her music, the actual lyrics are like so. It's all about self empowerment and self embracing your true self and set to ratchet ass New Orleans beat. I just love it. It's so good.
It's some really good music as well.
Good. And everybody was like, all the people in the thread, a bunch of white people, and everybody was like, oh my God, I've never even heard of this stuff. It just made my entire life. Thank you.
It's just, I would say not just now, but maybe like 2 years ago was blowing up from New Orleans, this local, you know, like hyper-localized form of
Yeah, like
of
Katie music. Redd and all those guys. Yeah, it's just really good. I love New Orleans Bounce. So we watched some documentaries this weekend.
And I we picked two, and I didn't think they were both going to be so race-centric, but I loved that they were. And
well, I guess technically we watched three. We'll start with the most frivolous one, which
I guess that wasn't race.
I hate Christian Laettner.
That shit was friggin'. I have a very different opinion. I still kind of hate Christian.
No, I definitely still hate Christian Laettner.
But I don't hate him as much.
Well, so 30 for 30, a bunch of people had talked about it. I think Carl had mentioned it to us. Shout out to you, Carl. And I think I heard Rod and Justin talking about it on Balls Deep Sports. But it's the 30 for 30 film series they do on ESPN. So here's, I think, this is the preview.
I hated Christian Laettner.
He was a bad dude, but he could back it up with his play.
It was good versus evil. We didn't like him.
I wanted to jump down and punch the dude in the face.
If people think sports is goody-goody, touchy-feely, it's not.
What if I told you, haters gonna hate? ESPN Films presents a 30 for 30 film, I Hate Christian Laettner.
So, yeah. We watched the whole thing. I will undoubtedly say I still hate Christian Laettner, just for the record. Nothing in it made me hate him any less. But it was interesting to see, you know, I mean, you know, some of the things that I had certainly, because of my hatred, allowed me to kind of write his skills off. And that was wrong of me. And it made me hate him more that I was wrong. So,
yeah, I mean,
that's extra hate. You know,
call a thing a thing. He is probably top 10 greatest college basketball player of all time.
No doubt.
He owns prolific records in terms
most games,
most
played,
NCAA
most,
tournament, most games played, scored. Most points scored. Yeah.
Sick amounts.
He went to four straight Final Fours, has two back-to-back national championships, and nobody even goes to school for 4 years in basketball practically anymore.
No, he was good.
He was real good.
Very dominant team. Hate Duke.
Yeah.
Still hate him.
In that game, and I didn't know this. I guess I had forgotten about it, that they were the same game, that when he stepped on the one individual.
Timberlake.
In retaliation, he was perfect. He went like 20 from 20, 10 from 10 from the floor, 10 from 10 from the field. Like literally had 30 some odd points shooting 100% from the floor. That's kind of, I'm saying like crazy.
No, it's crazy. He had like two of the top 10 shots, buzzer beater shots ever in the tournament. I mean, I'm not, like I said, what the doc allowed me to do is admit he, as you said, was one, is one of the top 10 greatest college basketball players ever. And I hate him for that, too. So fuck him. he apparently took to Twitter immediately after the airing about his lightning rod college career. And he filled out some questions and issued one big half-hearted apology to Kentucky's Aminu Timberlake, who was who he had stepped on. It was not a very vicious stomp to the chest, Lehner said. I think the refs made the right call. It wasn't very vicious on my end. It didn't have intent to harm, so I think they made the right call. They did punish me. They did punish my team. Kentucky got some free points in the ball, so I think they did the right thing. I don't know if it was somebody else or if it had been in today's game if I would have been kicked out. Oh, wait. Sorry. That was Christian Laettner, what Christian Laettner said last week when he categorically did not apologize. Here's what he said on Twitter.
Hey, Aminu. Some say I had the perfect game against you guys, but I made a mistake when I stepped on you. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Some say? Is that what he said? Rewind that. Say, I can hear that again.
Okay, I'll play it again.
This is a new apology.
Hey, Aminu. Some say I had the perfect game against you guys, but I made a mistake when I stepped on you. I'm sorry.
No, so what's the
that's an actual say? Sorry.
Is some say, though?
Some say his game was perfect, and he's saying it wasn't because he stepped
on. But it wasn't. Okay, that's right.
That's an actual apology. All right, Christian, I still hate you, just for the record.
Still very wooden. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although, and he did, he's taking a little bit, like, so there's like, you know, the, and so people aren't clear, the game against Kentucky when he stepped on Timberlake, he then had this perfect game and they won the national championship. And many argued that he should have been ejected from the game, that it was a technical and flagrant foul,
right?
Like throwing a punch, that should be an instant, not only ejection that from game, the game, but the next game, as well.
Potentially more.
And would have changed the national championship scope. Entirely. So Kentucky fans are pretty
white privilege.
Yeah. I would say if he was black, it would have been a different story. Absolutely,
for sure. Especially at that time, I feel like that was a lot.
We watched the Allen Iverson doc. What was it, 2 weeks ago?
Exactly.
And he was a high school kid in a bowling alley,
and
they tried to like railroad him, and in fact, did he served time in jail?
Yep. Before he went to the
and
NBA.
He didn't even throw a goddamn punch.
Nope.
Didn't do shit.
No. And then they had I guess he posted some videos of him talking to some fans.
And this is Christian Laettner. Right. I'm doing great. You got a question for me?
I guess my question will be, I have a lot I could ask.
Well, go ahead. Throw one out.
He gets on with Christian Laettner and gets, like, stumped.
There's one more.
Why do you suck so much?
Christian Laettner.
Christian Laettner.
How you doing? Are you enjoying the movie? is your son there? Did he have a question or anything for me?
Hey, come here. Yeah, he has a question for him. Are you kidding? Christian Laettner?
Yes, sir. Laettner. Yes, sir. I'm in Austin, Texas.
That is hilarious.
What would your question be? What happened in the NBA?
I would never ask him a question. I don't give a fuck about that dude.
13 years, like 6 or 7 different teams.
Yeah, fuck that dude.
He had the one All-Star year.
Mm-hmm.
He had a decent. I think it was with the Atlanta Hawks, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. He might have been on, like, he got drafted by the Timberwolves.
They were so bad. And I remember because they were an expansion franchise.
How many games do you play in the NBA?
I don't know. A lot.
No.
It was bad.
No, it's like, if you lose 60 games, like, yeah. I don't think they play, like, but like 90, 80.
Yeah. I remember it being, like, really bad because people thought, like, oh, he's going to be. Everybody was trying to, like, buy up Timberwolves stuff, all the douchebag Duke fans out there. I was a UNLV fan during that time, so I'll just say that. And I know you were a Michigan fan, so.
Fab Five, yeah. They almost did it.
Almost. Except for that fucking Laettner.
Yeah,
see?
Yeah, he did.
You can still hate him.
I can't still hate him.
It's great. I'm going to get one of those shirts. I still hate Christian Laettner.
There are shirts that say, I hate Christian Laettner. And he's got pictures on, like, Twitter of, like, people wearing, I still hate Laettner.
And they're
stepping on him in the same way that he did it, you know.
He needs to lean into it because it's not going anywhere. It was a perfect storm of too pretty, too white, too good, beat too many people. It was just too much. And he was a bully. So it was like a perfect storm of shit, of juicery.
Well, it's funny. The one, they had like a brand image consultant person saying that normally being, you know, more than attractive, like movie star, good looks, is an asset. It should help you as a brand, this and that. But you can't really have that and be sort of the villain at the same time. Like, you don't get both.
Right. Then you're just an asshole.
And you can't, I guess you can, it wasn't even just get the, be the villain. You can't be good looking and have all these other things and do all this, the way he handled it. And, you know, yeah, you're just an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
It was as more of the, like, he's a douche.
Exactly. You also watched all of Sense 8. Since the last episode after Rod and I spoiled half of it for you.
Friggin' consumed the crap out of it.
It was so good. It was really cool watching it with you because, like, I saw more stuff that I didn't notice the first time. So that was kind of cool on the first thing. I actually would watch it again. I mean that sincerely. I honestly would.
It was done. You and Rod talked about it, and I actually kind of tuned out because it was like your spoiler alert stuff.
Right.
But you both said, like, it was like, it found, like, the Wachowski siblings have the right medium. It seemed like a really good fit. It was like, it was beautiful, and the scenery and just the photography decisions. It was done really, really, really well. And you said that when you first watched it, you thought the one device they did, you're like, oh, this is kind of like, is this what they're going to do every episode? Like, you liked it, but you're like, oh, I hope they don't do that device again. And then they never did.
And that happened several times where I was like, that was cool, but I hope it's not a recurring thing. And it was like, nope, they'll never do that again. So don't worry about that. Like, it just, everything was so fresh. It was so different. The way that they interspersed the people and how they interact with each other changed all the time. But yet they made rules for the universe at the same time, you know? I am very excited for more, and I thought,
and they were kind of cool. They were kind of neat rules. Like, if the one outside the cluster sees you eye to eye, like, it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it had a lot. It was good. It was a very, really strong, like, first season. Netflix is not playing, so.
No. Yeah. And you had said that you thought that the Van Damme guys, like of the
arcs,
it was maybe the weakest.
It was.
And I would agree, but it was still really, really good.
It was super entertaining. I mean, that's like me saying the rest of them were 10 out of 10, and he was like 9 out of 10. You know what I mean? If I had to critique
he had the most. He had the most action of all the other ones.
He did.
Too.
He had the most action.
The most, like,
him and the
death
and
scenes.
And Son had a lot of big ones too.
That's true. Well, and she fought all of his too.
Yeah. So she was in any battle. Yeah. Somebody's fighting. She was there.
So I don't know if we talked a little bit about this or we didn't. But so I'll be honest. I have to admit, you know, I'm not a perfect individual. I've been conditioned in, you know, this world as a cishet white male and all that comes with. And you know, for me, it's about understanding some of those conditionings and shortening the latency from it, you know, occurring and either, you know, me thinking or acting or, you know what I'm saying? Like, really trying to see it for what it is and not beating myself up about it.
But acknowledge it. Right.
So, and it's not like to be, like, again, I'm not like ashamed of it, but I'm not like proud of it either. Like, I want to like understand it. And so this is something I have to really kind of like digest and unpack, and I'll do it on the show here with you. So while I'm watching, and I wasn't with you, I'd watched, I think, the first maybe like three or four by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a one of the eight is Lana, not Lana.
Nomi.
Noni.
Nomi.
Nomi. And she's a trans character and is one of the more, like, predominant, you know, central characters. It's all pretty related, but, like, Nomi gets a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know why. I guess, you know, cishet conditioning, transphobic conditioning to some degree. I had this sort of, like, knee-jerk kind of, like, in a millisecond. Like, your brain has, like, almost like a thought that's like, ooh, that stove's hot, and your hand pulls away, and it's like, wait a minute. I didn't think it was hot, but I knew it was hot, so I pulled my hand away.
Right.
In that same sort of, like, tiny little, like, pico burst of a second, I kind of thought, like, oh, like, you know, one of the Wachowski siblings has been transitioned. That goes by Lana. And I thought, well, oh, of course, you know, like, they're going to have a trans-centric character. And immediately I was like, well, that's a dumb thing to think. And then I started really, like, unpacking, like, the reasoning behind thinking that.
Mm.
And it was like, here's an individual, Lana Wachowski, that's probably the single most adept individual in Hollywood at telling this story, at showing the nuance of a trans character. And I thought, to her credit, Noni was an amazing character, mm-hmm. right? Done beautifully, right?
Beautifully.
And my first reaction was to almost invalidate it in the same sort of like way that I think white individuals do with regards to black testimony.
Mm.
Well, of course, a black person would think that's this way. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I really think it's this like defense mechanism, like muscle that's trained in terms of a conditioning, but it was weird. And it was like, I can't believe I kind of like for a half a second thought that, but like fortunately again, instantly realized like, wait a minute, that's crazy. Why do I think that? And like, not only why do I think that, but the thing that I kind of on a compulsory way thought is like the exact opposite of what the reality really should be. Like, Lana's like the best person.
Of course she should tell that story.
Of course she would tell that story. And did it fabulously. Yeah. But the immediate is to kind of like, you know.
Dismiss the narrative. Well, it's part of like instant otherizing. So then you dismiss the narrative of the otherized. But yes,
That's the first step, maybe.
Yeah, it is the first step.
Being able to more thoroughly otherize and oppress.
Right. I thought it was really good. And one of the things I was saying was that, and actually, while I'm talking, I'll try and pull up the Wachowski's IMDb. Anyways, I had, you know, they did The Matrix, and obviously that was really great and everything. But then.
And they did Cloud Atlas. They've done a few.
Right. They did a few other ones. But I felt all of their other movies were very, like, uneven. That's the best way I could describe it, I would say.
Well, and you said uneven from a, and I almost would describe it in a yin and yang, male and female.
It felt like something, things weren't matching up correctly. And I had only because I've seen this now, this really, I would say, you know, well-developed and true representation of what they could be, of their
craft,
potential.
Their craft,
yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, seeing it come to fruition here in this format has really, I can now like look back at the other things that they did, the other two Matrix movies. They did V for Vendetta, they did Speed Racer, Cloud Atlas, and they did Jupiter Ascending. And I didn't see Jupiter Ascending, but I saw the other movies, and I there was something different about the narratives. Almost seemed choppy. Like, it was like two different people were taking control at different times. Now, they write and direct together. So, they're not like Joel and Ethan Coen, where one of them is the writer and one of them is the director.
Right.
Right? So, the Wachowskis, they write together and they direct together. So, it's a pair of them. And I can imagine there was some, you know, someone transitions from male to female. And I would imagine that how things worked before when they were brothers, probably things would be different, or they were working through how this new dynamic was going to be. But in this, in Sense 8, it was like,
and I would almost
perfect
attribute it.
Balance of yin, of yang, of male, of female. I'm not talking about those in terms of characters. I'm talking about it in terms
just
of
feel.
The feel, yeah. The spirit of the show, how it worked together. And I just thought it was so good.
And imagine from a pair of siblings that have worked together for a long time. They have a, you know, an inner dialogue and kind of like a secondhand language between
right.
them, I'm sure. And imagine now one of those siblings is more free and comfortable and more open because they've transitioned to their, you know, ostensibly genuine self.
Right.
And the other sibling needing to be able to you know, have the language and the space to communicate with that sibling and continue working with that sibling. So it wasn't just that Lana developed different, perhaps, tools and language, but I think the other one's name is Andy, probably developed different ways of communicating with now his sister. It seems to, like, I guess your hypothesis enabled them to really come together in a way that has produced a really great
just
product.
Amazing, amazing piece. I would highly recommend it if you get Netflix. Sense 8 is the name of the show. And then, as I said, we did watch two documentaries, both of which I thought, in hindsight, kind of were the perfect things to watch after the Rachel Dolezal ridiculata,
right.
Because they really went to the heart of the problems with race relations and how they play out in personal lives and communities, which is exactly what Rachel never had to go through because she's not black and just decided to be black. And I think both of the pieces really go to the heart of what the black experience means and what that's defined as. So the first one was Southern Rites, and I'll play the preview for that.
And that's R-I-T-E-S.
R-I-T-E-S, yes.
In 2009, I was commissioned to go down to Georgia and photograph the segregated proms.
I was told that if my date was going to be black, he wouldn't be let in.
I was so mystified how this could still be happening in the 21st century. And little did I know, as the film would unravel, that there would be so much more than just a story about segregated proms, but really a story about race in general.
I always knew that I wanted to return to this town, so I thought that I was making a story about a town coming together to have their first integrated prom, and then a tragedy happened.
911.
My name is David. You come out here, because I think I heard one of you.
My
22-year-old son was taken from me.
We've seen this on television a lot lately with young people whose lives did not need to be lost, people who were unarmed in situations where they were thought to be more dangerous than they really were. This film really explores the racial divide. We see it in the criminal justice system, the way people interact in their social lives, and then, of course, in voting as well.
My dad is the very first black chief of police, and if he gets sheriff, it'll be really historic.
It's a really complicated story, and these are conversations that are hard to have, and I think they're necessary conversations.
There are aspects of the ending that say, man, it's the same story over again and nothing's changed. But you see some sense that people might start coming together. And so that gives me some hope.
So the documentary goes through the murder or killing of a young black man, a young teen, actually, who was caught fooling around with this white man's biracial daughter.
Justin Patterman.
Mm-hmm. And it was pretty heartbreaking to watch it all unravel. You know, you know what got me was just that this white man who killed this boy, he really thought it was the boy's fault that he was killed. Like, for real, he had absolutely no remorse whatsoever. In his mind, that boy should have never been anywhere near his daughter. And he deserved to die. And if he didn't want to die, he shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, why was he in my house?
Why was he in my house?
Despite being invited there, you know. There was not only was there not any remorse, it was almost a pathological approach to convincing oneself that what you did was justified.
Yeah.
And it's couched in all this sort of stand your ground and self-defense and, you know, protect your home. And the lengths that not only he but the system went to sort of protect that narrative was just, you know, and to see it in action. He got charged, right? It's like, hey, we haven't seen charges all the time, so let's start like, okay, good, he got charged. And he got charged aggressively. He got charged with like 7 or 8 different counts and everything from murder down to like aggravated assault
and there was, you know, a kidnapping charge because they
held him without
he held the two boys and right. and he was holding them basically with a shotgun in their face and they took off to run.
It wasn't a shotgun, it was a 22.
Oh well, they took off to run and that's when he killed the one. Correct. He shot him in the back like while he was exiting the place, so correct. It was beyond
and fired
just that.
And fired once before and yep. missed and then shot him and then just shot on the side
yep.
and then shot as Justin and his cousin were running
yep.
two more times into the woods, like, you know, blindly
because
they can people can do that
yeah.
and purportedly the individual, the cousin, Justin's cousin that survived, said that Norman said, I can kill both you and probably use an epithet, and it won't make a difference. Nobody will care.
Yep.
You know, and that's when they're like, that's shit, we gotta run.
Go.
We gotta get out of here. Yeah. It was, and just again, like pathologically, logically convincing himself, and the way that in court, right? So, like, there's a trial, and it's a trial supposedly to see if Norman is guilty of all of these charges. They spent more fucking time in this courtroom talking about the dead individuals, the victims, Justin, and why he was at this house and what was he doing there and at what time was it and what did it mean and about this guy's daughter. They didn't say how many shots were fired. They didn't say anything about Norman's language and what he said to those boys. I mean, really, it was like, I don't want to call it a sham, but it kind of was.
Yeah, it was like kangaroo court
type shit. And then fucking Norman at one point, I don't know if you remember, Leslie, said, you know, I pray for them. I pray for their family every night. What have they done for me? Probably nothing. Like, what? He's the victim here?
Yeah, well, in his eyes he is.
And like crossed his arms angrily. What have they done for me? You killed their fucking son. What do you want him to do for you?
Crazy. So Rachel Dolezal, did you have any moments in your childhood where somebody almost killed you because of your skin color? Or somebody killed somebody that was related to you because of their skin color?
And
just making sure. And you didn't have a traumatic incident associated with your skin color in your childhood.
And listen, Dolezal is pretending to be black. And the young woman that's this individual, Norman's daughter, she's biracial.
Yes.
And she had some... Was it internalized depression?
Yeah, there's definitely. I mean, her dad is a full-on racist.
Her dad's a full-on racist.
Full-on racist.
That killed a black man she invited to her home.
Yeah.
And then she felt very, she was holding a lot of weight in terms of not doing anything after her dad kind of
caught
like,
them.
Caught them. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Letting them sit there and be held hostage at gunpoint and not saying anything, not doing anything. So I
forgot about the sheriff until they wrote the, I heard the preview clip we played.
Yeah.
And the sheriff story, that almost like, I don't think I've ever seen someone
broken
on film like that. Like watch them just like, you know, it was kind of, it wasn't kind of, it was depressing. So he was a chief of police, one of the first black chief of police in this, you know, predominantly white community, chief for like 20 some odd years. Running for, was it sheriff? Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, you know, great. You know, we got your support. And seems like it should have been him in a landslide. He's winning polls. And then all of a sudden he lost. And he lost by 100 votes. And they won't tell him who those 100 votes are. And they won't issue a recount because it's not sufficient. And some high profile people said to his face, this man's face, they ain't just ready for an N-word sheriff.
Nope. That's what they said. So it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. That wasn't going to happen.
And just
so has that happened to you too, Rachel? Have you had a moment in your life that you were not able to attain something that you deserve because of your skin color? Because if that didn't happen to you, then you're not black either.
And his daughter, oh my God, she even said that, and she was like pragmatic about it. But she's like, what white person wants a black man telling them what to do? What white person wants a black man to have power and be sheriff? I can't. I'm done.
I'm leaving.
I'm taking my kids.
Yeah,
we're never coming back.
She left the town.
She said, my parents have been here and they've seen a lot. And I haven't seen nearly what they've seen, but I've seen too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough. And she's gone. She packed up and left.
Yeah. So the second documentary that we saw was called Little White Lie. And it was written and directed by Lacey Schwartz. And I have the preview for that, too.
I come from a long line of New York Jews. I grew up in a world with synagogue, Hebrew school, bar mitzvahs. So it never occurred to me that I was passing. I wasn't pretending to be something I wasn't. I actually grew up believing I was white.
Show us how you can stand on your side. Oh, that's terrific. How do you do that?
We lived almost picture-perfect kind of life for a while. So when Lacey decided she was going to tell the story, I was a little nervous about it.
If you look too closely at it, it didn't make any sense. So we found ways to see what we wanted to believe.
I always looked at you like you looked black. To me, you're just like a Jewish kid who, I don't know.
White people will think anything. Crazy things. I'll know white people for a long time.
Today's the day. We did it.
It really is the power of denial. How the hell did anybody sort of not acknowledge this?
It just seems like the 600-pound gorilla in the room to kind of just refuse to see it.
Hmm.
When it came time to apply to college, I had to check a box. The only box I had ever known was white, so I just didn't check anything. And based off a photograph, I was admitted to college as a black student. And I was afraid of not being a part of the world that I had grown up in anymore.
If I could have done my life differently, there were a lot of things I would have done differently, but in the end, not really.
You know, the fact is, like, whatever happened with you and Daddy and that inability to talk about things, that is what I carry on. Nobody talked about everything because it was all secrets.
This documentary was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, really.
Shout out to Lacey. That was
just
so good.
You can follow her at Lacey, L-A-C-E-Y, Schwartz. And she just, I mean, it was so amazing to see her be so vulnerable and raw and sure. tell this extremely personal story about her family. And if you didn't get it from the preview, she was born to two white Jewish parents in New York City, and was raised as if they were her biological parents, but when in fact her mother had had an affair with a black man and she was biracial. And so they showed in that, or they played in that clip, when she went to college, she went to Georgetown, she didn't check a box, but they had to send a headshot. They looked at her and they were like, oh yeah, she's black. And she became black. She went to college and she got enveloped or accepted into the black community.
Because that, what you just said, like, you know, for her, when she talked about it in the movie, and I remember to myself thinking, and I maybe we even talked a little bit about it. So Rachel was masquerading in blackface and basically getting away with it and doing all she wanted to do at her kind of will and just whatever she wanted. Lacey was living her life, you know, I guess she used the word passing, but you know, as a white person, but society, Georgetown University specifically, in a very abrupt way deemed her, no, you're black. Right? So, like, here's Rachel just being able to kind of put on a costume, walk around. Right. Whereas Lacey was, you know, for lack of a better word, and she and all the relatives and people in the movie kind of danced around. She's like, well, we kind of thought, you know, you looked maybe more Sicilian. You have this one relative, the grandparent, that's kind of, you know, darker right.
they,
complected.
They, as the guy said, like, white people will believe anything. And they told themselves a lie and then they all went with it. And when you're a child, of course you believe what your family tells you. But when, you know, me being the viewer looking at these videotapes of her as a child and growing up, it's like, but she's a black kid. Like, for real. She's biracial, but there is no doubt that she is for sure black. And so they would constantly be in, you know, she had such a self-loathing because she was different, but yet when people would ask her, you know, what are you, and she'd be like, what do you mean, I'm Jewish, I'm white, because that's all anybody told her about her identity. So she spent her childhood feeling so different and not knowing why she felt different and why she looked different. And they showed, I think, one thing where it said, like, what one thing would you change about yourself? And she wished that her skin was lighter.
Yeah. And I don't want to say I'm like mad at her mom or dad or nothing.
No, I'm mad at her mom for sure.
It's a little unfair that her issues and her inability to talk about it ended up putting a lot of weight, you know, and Lacey even said in the movie that, like, she's carrying this, like, this has been, you know, an issue for her. And then when she went to talk to her dad, and again, I'm not in those shoes, I'm not trying to, like, throw shade. Her dad, you know, I assume is raising a daughter his whole life, and, you know, maybe he looks at her and sees the affair, I don't know, but they just, like, refused to talk about it. It was like, okay, we had this one thing we said one time, and now we're never going to mention it again. And that approach and attitude to things like this, it just really hurts. I imagine it was hard for Lacey.
And yeah, I think it was, but I also think that it gets to the heart of, like, this issue with white people and race, which is that they never have to think about race. And so when you're in a scenario in your world and your world view and your POV never has you actually have to think about race, when you're put in a position to have to think about it, it's very uncomfortable. And I imagine, like, to me, I don't think that her father ever saw her as evidence of the affair, but I think that this idea that his daughter was not white only was very unsettling. And I don't know how he was going to digest that, because what is it when she comes to him and she says, Dad, I need to let you know, you know, I identify as a black woman. And he says, duh, I see your, you know, the music you listen to, the people you hang out with, entertainment you like, the clothes you wear, obviously I see that you identify as a black woman. But then doesn't take it any further. It's like, well, I that's because I'm biracial, and so of course I am a black woman.
Well,
like,
and Lacey felt that was dismissive too.
I think it was dismissive, but I think it was also a coping mechanism on his part too.
And then he said in a voicemail on the thing later, like, well, this is adding stress and I can't do this right now. And, you know, maybe another time. And I thought kind of like, wow, it's very convenient and, you know, not white of you, but, you know, like you said, he doesn't have to think about race. And now all of a sudden he's uncomfortable and, you know, his daughter's going through this, you know, really serious thing.
And the other piece that was really, I think, I draw such a parallel to this Bullshit Rachel story is that, you know, Lacey went from classifying herself as white because that's all she knew and feeling like an outsider, having bad hair and too dark a skin. And because of that, she wasn't allowed to be white. at her bar mitzvah.
Right.
At her bat mitzvah, one of the people at the synagogue comes up to her and her mother and says, oh, it's so nice to have an Ethiopian Jew here.
And
so this is a biracial woman, and she's not allowed to be white. But this non-biracial white woman is allowed to be black? Why? I'm just trying to figure it out.
And what you just said, though, that she really, that society in othering her simply on the appearance didn't allow her to really embrace her blackness in any way and to not fit in. It's like getting all the benefits of none and the privilege of none of the other. It's like almost like a man without a country. Like she was kind of in limbo.
Yeah. And then when she went to college and she was like, oh, I'm black. And she's like, it was just a strange thing that she never was black before. And now everybody assumes she was black. Not only was she black, but she had lighter skin and she had good hair. So she went from being in a community that looked at her features and her physical characteristics as undesirable to a community that, for good, for better, or for worse, were looking at those same physical characteristics in a positive light. And so I really highly recommend that people watch it. I think it's really, when you want to have a nuanced discussion about what makes up race, what race means in our lives, I think that Lacey's story is really critical in illustrating what it means.
Yeah.
Because despite the fact that Lacey was raised and as a child thought that she was white, she was treated as though she was black.
As an other.
And that is the difference. And that is what you cannot decide to make up, Rachel. That's not something that you can later on pretend occurred to you.
And I think this is a good summation for it. And I thought it was brilliant. And so she's talking to her various cousins and relatives and people that knew her as a young child when she was presenting herself as, you know, simply white or Jewish, wasn't identifying with her black.
She
didn't know about it.
Not identifying. Right. She didn't know about it.
Right. But so she asked, I think it was a cousin, and she said, well, you know, I'm, you know, my father was black and I'm biracial and I'm black. And, you know, what do you think about that? And I'm black. And he goes, what does that even mean?
What does that mean?
Like, to him, it was like, well, you're still Lacey. You're still my cousin. Like, you're just who you are. I thought it was really, you know, a good way of submitting that. What does it even mean?
Yes, but I think that to her it did mean something. But because he's white, he wouldn't understand what that could mean.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I know that Rachel Dolenz can't be black. Because of what that cousin said. What does that mean? Because I don't believe that Rachel Dolenz knows what it means. So you can't pretend to be something that you don't even know the definition of. It's not something that you can learn, being black.
You know, and even we haven't talked much about her and we don't need to because, you know, whatever. But I'm surprised there hasn't been, like, at some point more of the, like, wait a minute, y'all. Like, she made up these false, fake-ass, like, wannabe, like, racist events, right? She's drumming up fake, I don't know what that is, like, racism von Munchausen? Is that Baron von Munchausen? Racism von Munchausen?
Yeah.
Like, that to me, that invalidates everything.
Sure.
That there's so much that invalidates, but...
But that's part of
that's
her...
That's a non-starter.
Yeah, because that's part of her trying to make up the background of a black person, a black woman. You have to include moments in which your blackness makes you feel badly, because that's just something that comes along with being black. It's an experience that you will have.
Oh, you think she was trying that shoe on?
So she said that this was more part of her ruse. Now she's been put upon. Now she's been the target. Now she's been the victim, because that's how she sees black women. You know, it's really just disgusting. And I will say that we won't talk about it anymore here, but we talked about not necessarily Rachel in depth, but a lot about what this situation has revealed in both the white and especially in the black community on the Ferguson Response Network podcast. And that's available right now. Just search Ferguson Response.
I'm going to give an unrequested, unsolicited super plug. I'm going to just say your best at the FRN's best episode. It was really good, y'all. If you hadn't listened to the Ferguson Response Network, that's one to catch. And was his name Junior?
Yeah, Junior Birchall.
Fire. Talking about, and I had never thought about it, but what you're describing and with Rachel and, you know, this racial tourism, the fact that supremacy in white culture and society functions by consuming blackness mm-hmm. in various forms yep. And devouring blackness.
Yeah.
And
here she is again, devouring our very identity. And we're not supposed to be upset about
that. That shit was deep, dude. Junior went.
Yeah. Honestly, I say, especially any black women that listen or any people at all that have been confused by what the response has been from black women and black men and how that this has been playing out. I really highly recommend that you listen to the Ferguson Response podcast from this week. It's called The Auction Block Stare because we really go there and we have three men on and they dissect this in a really nuanced and targeted fashion. It really helped me personally work through my own anger and feelings surrounding it, and I've felt better since then.
It was Ricky and Junior, and who's the other?
And William J. Jackson. Shout out to him.
And William J. Jackson as well. Yeah. The atmosphere. The repartee that you all had. Oh man, it was.
And the accountability, because that's really, I had to pick who I was going to have on the show because I really didn't want to have this conversation and it be about some bullshit. So I had to seek out men that were really going to come and own this crap that has been going on and how black women have been being treated in the wake of this by, you know, everybody from these hotep ass dudes to, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jelani Cobb and all of these, you know, black academics that have been completely dismissive of the feelings of black women on this subject. And it's been really hurtful. It's hurt a lot. And like I said, I was carrying a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger about it. And after the show, I felt like an entire weight was lifted off of me. So anybody else that has been feeling similarly or you're interested in the subject, please check out Ferguson Response Network podcast. And I'm also going to give a quick shout out to one Chris Fett from Movie Trailer Reviews. We actually were the first couple to star or to guest on his spinoff show, Hell No Cupid, where he talks about dating and relationships. It's one of his premium shows. You can go to movietrailerreviews.net to check that out. It should come out today or tomorrow. But again, you have to be a premium subscriber. But you should, because Chris is awesome and Sandy Check's awesome, and it's just, he's great. So,
hey, you know, I said to him when we were on the show, it's always, we've done this. This is now three times.
Yeah,
we've done,
three times.
It's
yeah.
one twice on his show and once on our show.
Yep.
The time just goes by.
Yeah, so fast.
It just doesn't seem like it was all of a sudden like, whoa, it's been 2 hours?
Yeah.
It didn't seem like Charles at all.
And if you do listen, you'll get to hear a lot about how Drew and I got together, some more about our relationship dynamic and our thoughts about relationships. So, yeah, that'll be a little insight into the interracial John if you're interested. And again, that's movietrailerviews.net, and I'll have the link in the show notes. We do have some stuff coming up this week. Our associate producer Carl will be back with us on Wednesday.
Good game for that.
Very excited. Next week we have Roshani from the Single Simulcast, which is going to be awesome. And then I think 2 weeks after that, July 15th, we have Nick Drew from What's the Tea coming on. So we got some really great guest appearances coming up. And that's it. What else you got? That's it.
You know, I just would say, things are good. No real.
Yes, I know the blessing. I know the blessing. Father God blessing. One more blessing. I know the blessing. I know the blessing. Them can't stop me. I am blessed.
Right, on the reel, we moved to Michigan. We're in a crummy apartment, babe. It's not ideal, but we're together and we're moving in the direction we want to. We're making things happen, and I'm here with you, and I love you. And just because we're here together, and no matter what it is, that makes it blessed. So I love you, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks. And you're right. We are very blessed. Indeed.
Good night, everybody.
High five.